Welcome to Freshfields Global Investigations podcast. My name's Jeff Nicholas. I'm a member of the Global Investigations Group at Freshfields, and I'm here today with two of my partners, Matthew Bruce and Adam Siegel, both of whom are also members of the Global Investigations Group.
Hello, everyone.
Good afternoon.
Managing criminal risk continues to be a concern for most major companies, and today what we're going to focus on is the early planning in response to suspected wrongful conduct. To start, we're going to frame the conversation around where we stand today in relation to corporate criminal liability. What's the appetite of prosecutors to use criminal law to hold companies and indeed individuals to account for corporate criminal conduct? 2 years ago, before Trump took office, some commentators expected a significant reduction in DOJ investigations into companies. Adam, is this something we've seen come to pass?
Well, I think the unfortunate answer for corporations around the world is at least not yet. Now, obviously, there's a bit of a lag because, as people listening may recognize, criminal investigations can last for many years. But at least in the last few years, since President Trump has taken office, we've seen a number of significant resolutions continuing in the anti-bribery space, some in the export controls area, rate fixing. I mean, the large areas of investigation have continued to yield resolutions during the first 2 years. So I think the short answer, Jeff, is we haven't seen a significant downturn or a downturn in any respect. The proof will be over the next couple of years as the potential for any new policies or policy changes to become implemented, we'll have to see what happens. But today, our enforcement regime in the U.S. remains robust and active.
Matthew, what's the position in the U.K.? Because we have seen change here in the sense that we've got a new director at the Serious Fraud Office.
Well, that's right, Jeff. We do have a new director of the Serious Fraud Office in Lisa Osofsky, and she takes over a busy caseload. The SFO has over 40 ongoing cases that have been publicly announced. Nearly half of those are bribery and corruption cases, and in four of those, individuals have been charged. Of course, the SFO isn't just investigating and prosecuting cases of bribery. One of the most high-profile cases is a case against executives of a major bank, which focuses on unlawful financial assistance, and we also see other cases focusing on false accounting. The new director of the SFO has used her first speech as director and some of her subsequent outings since then to highlight her intention to build the SFO's intelligence unit. So that will allow them to more proactively detect issues. But she's also focused on international cooperation. She stressed, for example, her commitment to continuing the close cooperation between the SFO and the Department of Justice, the DOJ. She's already met them and the FBI, despite her acknowledged differences in approach to investigations on this side of the pond compared to the US. And I think the focus on international cooperation is a common theme that many prosecutors, Jeff, are very keen to emphasize.
Yeah, I guess we've been seeing that in a number of countries around the world. Indeed, two of the biggest settlements recently have been cooperation between the Dutch and the US authorities. It's not just there. We've seen Singapore, Brazil, the US, all involved in coordinated settlements. But it's not all bad news. There are a growing number of options for companies to use to seek to resolve matters with authorities. So, for example, we're seeing a growing use of more formal agreements, such as deferred prosecution agreements. The UK, France, Singapore, and now even Argentina have such regimes, and they're expected to see the introduction of such a regime in Canada and also in Australia. In the UK, we're seeing discounts of up to 50% in relation to resolutions through the DPA regime. By contrast, the first French DPA ended up in a penalty that was equal to the maximum fine that would have been incurred had the matter gone through to prosecution. But of course, in the DPA regimes, we're seeing benefits in addition to the reductions in financial penalties. There's an opportunity, for example, to exert a greater degree of control over how the process is to be resolved, and potentially also the benefit of avoiding duplicative penalties through coordinated settlements with various other authorities. But what many of these regimes are building on, what many of these regimes are developments from, is the US DPA regime. And Adam, what are we seeing in terms of developments in the US market around resolutions?
You're obviously right that a deferred prosecution agreement regime presents potential benefits for a company. But what I think the Department of Justice decided through its recent Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, FCPA corporate enforcement policy, is to offer even a greater carrot for companies who are prepared to engage in the types of activities that the policy sets forth. What the policy basically says is a company that's prepared to do four things. So one, self-disclose, come forward, tell the government about misconduct of which they're previously unaware. Two, cooperate fully, and we'll spend a little bit of time later talking about what cooperation really means to the Department of Justice. Three, remediate, make sure that any underlying causes of the potential misconduct have been fixed, and four, disgorge any ill-gotten gains, will be presumed to qualify for something better than a deferred prosecution agreement. The policy tells us that a company that does all four of those things will earn a presumption of a declination, which is to say, no court proceeding, no charge, and no long-term agreement with the government at all. It's important to understand, however, that jumping through all four of those hurdles is no easy task. And even if a company does, the Department of Justice retains the discretion, based on its own assessment of potentially aggravating factors, things like the involvement of senior management or the length of the ongoing misconduct, to not grant a declination in a particular case, but instead to ask the company to enter into a deferred prosecution agreement and then apply, Jeff, the type of 50% discount to the fine that you've been discussing in other DPA regimes. So there is some good news. A company can assess the likelihood that it can pass all four of these tests and potentially not be prosecuted at all. But there is no guarantee when you start the dialogue with the Department of Justice that the lawyers handling your case will agree that the company is indeed entitled to such a declination. I should also note that the department has helpfully announced that this policy, though initiated in the context of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, will be applied to other economic crimes when appropriate.
Interesting. Those four factors, which I think the U.S. has been leading on, are factors we see across a number of the other regimes, indeed probably common to all those regimes in some form or other. We're going to look at two, maybe three of those issues in a little more detail. Firstly, starting with the often difficult question of self-reporting, then looking at cooperation, and perhaps at the end we'll come back to briefly look at the question of remediation. Let's look at self-reporting first. If a company is dealing with serious, credible allegations of misconduct, then at some point there will be a need to consider whether it's appropriate, whether it wishes to self-report that conduct to a relevant authority. I should stress that this question of whether to self-report is a matter that needs to be considered on the facts of any particular case. Different companies are likely to give different weight to the various factors that might be taken into account in making such a decision. And all we can do really today is illustrate the sorts of issues that need to be factored into that consideration. Let me look at just one or two of those issues. First of all, we need to look at the nature of the evidence. And Adam's already touched on this to some extent. How credible is the evidence? Now, are we looking at conduct that's isolated or is it endemic? Is it something that's a problem in the company's business more generally? Are we dealing with senior individuals or can we say this is the conduct of a rogue employee within the organization? Over what sort of time period did this conduct take place? And does that, for example, evidence systemic failings? Is it a poor attitude in the business to the question of compliance? All those are factors which are relevant to, in a sense, the seriousness of the conduct one's dealing with, and will all be factors that the relevant prosecution authorities are likely to take into account in determining how to take forward any particular matter that is reported. I think, secondly, we need to look at the likelihood that the relevant authorities will either know of the issue already and or that it will become known to them, because clearly that is something that's going to factor into your judgments as to whether to make a self-report, whether to be the party that takes the lead in terms of taking forward that issue. So what are the risks of leaks within the company? How many people already know about the issues? Has it arisen through a whistleblower report? And if it has, what steps have been taken to ensure that that whistleblower is comfortable that the issue is being properly dealt with by the company? And if you report, what's the likely interest that the authorities will have in the issue itself, but also perhaps looking at the extent to which the authorities might use a report on one particular issue to look at wider issues within the business. Again, for example, if there are issues in that sector in which the company is operating, and this is an opportunity for the regulators to think through whether there are broader issues in the company that's reporting itself. Also looking at potential outcomes. Now, we've touched on this already in terms of magnitudes of fine, but what is the likelihood of being able to reach a resolution here? And what's the risk of, for example, follow-on litigation? Are there likely to be aggravating factors which will weigh against resolution? Go back here, for example, to the questions around seniority of employees involved and whether or not the conduct can be said to be isolated or more endemic, exemplifying some failings within that business. All difficult issues, as I said at the start, none of which lead to a simple answer. Every one of these situations needs to be looked at in its own circumstances. Matthew, let's go back to the difficult issue, which is timing of a self-report. When does a company have enough information to decide whether it should be approaching a particular prosecutor or regulator or the like?
Authorities aren't going to expect you to take every single allegation to them. They'll normally expect a company to have done some work to understand the credibility of the allegations made. And of course, the company itself is going to want to understand that for a number of reasons. But authorities such as the DOJ and the SFO have made clear that early reporting is vital and that delay could count against the company. But what does that really mean? Well, there's always going to be a judgment call, and there are a number of options to consider for the company, each of which will have potential benefits and downsides, and it will depend, obviously, on the circumstances. You could take the matter to the authorities early, very early. And for some, the timing might be dictated by that entity's legal obligations. There may, for example, be a mandatory obligation to report suspicious activities to the authorities. Now, of course, there are going to be risks associated with such an early engagement. You won't have had much time to carry out any meaningful investigation. And so the nature of the issue, the extent of the company's potential exposure, that may all be ill-defined. There's also a risk. Particularly the SFO in the UK will ask you not to speak to certain individuals because the prosecutor wants to get the first account. The SFO puts a lot of weight on this and can be pretty uncomfortable with the idea that the company's lawyers have spoken to individuals first. And that may be difficult to resist for companies that want to be considered cooperative, but it obviously puts the company in the difficult position of not being able to properly investigate further and better understand the full facts. So a second option is to conduct a detailed but targeted documentary review and report on the basis of that review. The advantage of that is that the company can't be accused of trampling on the crime scene by having spoken to witnesses, and it creates more boundaries around scope. Of course, you've got a risk of detection that is prolonged throughout the period you're conducting that review. And if the allegations would then reach the authorities in another way, then you might risk losing credit for a genuine self-report. And of course, if you just do a documentary review, you can't provide context to the documents. So you may be taking a report into the authorities based on an incomplete picture. As most listeners will appreciate, comments in email viewed in isolation can sometimes paint quite a damning picture. And there can often be an innocent or reasonable explanation, but that only really becomes clear when you speak to the people involved. A third option is to blitz the documents and then conduct limited interviews to get a better understanding of the documents of concern. And you could well reach the conclusion there that the allegations are without merit or that on balance, there's no need to report the matter to the authorities. If you do then decide to report, you've got a better understanding of the facts and that may allow you to put the company's best foot forward by presenting mitigating factors or information at the same time. And you might be better prepared for other potential proceedings, such as civil proceedings that might arise in parallel. But of course, the detection risk then is much longer and the risks of leaks that you referred to, Jeff, might start to increase. So it's always going to be a judgment call depending on the circumstances.
Fundamentally, it's not an easy decision, and there's no one right answer for every case. Each case is, unfortunately, unique and challenging in its own ways. I think the prosecutors in the U.S. would say they would like to be called very, very quickly. I don't think they want to be called every time, as Matthew said, there's a filing on the hotline because it would overwhelm them, but they certainly expect a company to be very prompt in making a disclosure. And I'll state the obvious, if in order to qualify for a declination, you need to make a genuine self-disclosure, all of the issues that Matthew discussed ring true. The longer you wait, the more people you interview, the greater chance either of detection by another source or by a leak from within the investigation from one of the witnesses who you've contacted. So I think the calculus is the same for all of us. It's just very, very challenging to decide, have we learned enough to form an analytically sound assessment of what our best option is here? Should we keep looking, or are we at that moment now where we can make that decision?
It's particularly challenging, isn't it, Adam? Because if you do decide to self-report, you need to be prepared for what cooperation means. You touched on cooperation as being one of the tenets earlier, because once you're in, you're in. So you've got to go in with your eyes wide open. What would you tell a company considering self-reporting so it's prepared for cooperation that might be expected?
I'd start out by saying it's not for the faint of heart. The FCPA corporate enforcement policy sets forth five separate bullet points of what it expects from a company that intends to claim that it's cooperated and therefore deserves a declination. At a fundamental level, the policy explains that it requires proactive rather than reactive cooperation. That means that you can't sit back and wait for DOJ to ask the right questions. It's your responsibility to provide the DOJ with information that you think they would want to know about. Well, then, what kind of information are we talking about? It's very clear. All relevant facts gathered during the company's independent investigation, but not just in a harmonized or synthetic way. The DOJ policy tells us that the DOJ wants attribution of facts to specific sources, so long as it's consistent with the privilege. It wants timely updates. It wants rolling production of information. And very, very importantly, it wants all facts related to the involvement by individuals in the underlying potentially criminal conduct. That could be officers, employees, agents, third parties. It's not just proactive cooperation, and it's not just the provision of everything. The policy tells us that a company must timely preserve and collect documents. Well, that may be bad enough, but it keeps going. That includes the disclosure of overseas documents, including places that could theoretically be beyond the reach of the Department of Justice. It includes the facilitation of the third-party production of documents by business partners or other entities with whom the entity has a relationship. And when requested and appropriate, translations of relevant documents that exist in foreign languages. Cooperation also impacts the way you go about your investigation. So, Matthew, you made the point that the SFO will sometimes ask a company to stand down and not conduct an investigation so that it can be the first body to interview a potential witness. The policy also defines cooperation to include deconfliction of witness interviews and other steps, which basically means, notwithstanding the obligation to conduct a thorough investigation and report all relevant facts to the DOJ, a company also has to stand down if the DOJ asks it to because there's some piece of the investigation that it prefers to do itself. And then I think, again, somewhat controversially, cooperation includes making available for interviews by DOJ all officers and employees who have relevant information, including not necessarily just people inside the company, but agents, former employees, former officers, and other individuals. A company cannot compel any human being to participate in an investigative process. We have a Fifth Amendment in the United States which prohibits self-incrimination, and a company can't make even a current employee cooperate. But the government has told us that using best efforts to facilitate that kind of cooperation by individuals is part of what defines cooperation. So the short answer, Matthew, is once you open this door, you have to walk through it and you lose a significant amount of control about how you're going to conduct your investigation. It's clear from the policy that the Department of Justice has a very high standard for cooperation. Now, let me be clear. Lawyers have a role in this. It's, of course, our job to negotiate with the Department of Justice to try to agree upon a reasonable set of parameters for an internal investigation and a reasonable set of parameters for what cooperation is, notwithstanding the breadth of these expectations. But a company does need to understand that it will ultimately be the unilateral decision of the Department of Justice whether or not the company qualifies for a declination. So notwithstanding the best advocates in the world who will do a great job trying to have a reasonable agreement with the Department of Justice, it ultimately largely remains up to the Department of Justice how much will be enough.
Adam, you've mentioned on a couple of occasions there the position of individuals. What sort of issues does this create for a board, for a company, when considering whether to self-report and therefore cooperate with the government in relation to an investigation?
It's been a few years now, Jeff, that the department has formally told companies who are seeking cooperation credit that cooperation means essentially giving the department information about relevant employees, relevant officers, or other individuals who were involved in causing the misconduct that the company is now trying to unburden itself regarding. This, as you can imagine, creates all kinds of complexities. There are going to be instances where corporations think, to your earlier point of what is the right thing to do, they might have a corporate desire to begin a dialogue with the Department of Justice and unburden themselves, as I said, from past wrongdoing. But they may be much more reluctant to do so if that means facilitating the investigation and prosecution of current or former employees or directors.
From a perspective of the UK, individuals are a particular focus of the prosecutor. That is a way that will change behaviour. Lisa Rosofsky, the new director of the SFO, has indicated that she is looking to speed up the prosecution and resolution of prosecutions against individuals.
Before finishing, we should briefly mention the importance of remediation. What the prosecutors really mean by remediation is they're looking to understand whether there's a risk of reoffending within a company. Because if there's that risk, then they will not be offering the sorts of resolutions we've been discussing. They'll look in that regard at various things. Obviously, they'll look at compliance, the company's attitude to compliance, what they've done to enhance compliance in light of the allegations that have come out, another subject of the investigation. But they'll be looking more generally at wider issues. And one of the questions they will ask is whether there are individuals still in the company who, at least in their minds, might have been guilty of allowing this type of conduct to occur within the organization. And that itself can raise some quite difficult issues for a business in how it is going to have to respond to the investigation if it's looking to reach a resolution with one or more authorities.
It also makes it far more difficult for lawyers who conduct internal investigations to convince sometimes employees or officers, and particularly former employees and officers, to participate in an investigation. It's likely to make some individuals less likely to cooperate in an internal investigation if they're concerned that at the end of the day, their name will be on the list of potential bad actors provided to the Department of Justice. Lastly, it makes the decision of whether or not to self-disclose even more complicated, because the very individuals who are entrusted with making that decision and owe fiduciary duties to the company may essentially be going down a path in which they end up being part of the investigation. So things like the corporate enforcement policy continue to encourage a self-disclosure and cooperation, but it has made the issue far more tricky, and it's made it a very, very important ethical obligation for lawyers representing companies to be extra clear with all people they interact with that their only client is the entity, and not to create any misimpression that they are lawyers for the individuals.
So that brings us to the end of this podcast. Before finishing, as we've discussed, there are a number of quite often difficult strategic issues that a company needs to take into account in deciding how to proceed with an investigation. There's no one size fits all, but understanding the questions to ask, understanding the factors to consider, and how they interplay with each other is important in ensuring that the company can make the right judgments in looking at how to proceed with an investigation. Thank you for listening, and goodbye from myself, Jeff Nicholas.
Goodbye.
And thank you very much.